After the fireworks of the Reformation, you know, Luther nailing his theses to the castle church door at Wittenberg, Calvin building Geneva into a model Christian city, Zwingli dying sword in hand on a Swiss battlefield, we might think that the church just settled into a golden age of spiritual vitality. Great doctrine, great preaching, remarkable hymns, everybody's happy. Except, of course, the Roman Catholics. But no, not so much. What actually followed was something historians call the era of Protestant scholasticism, a period where Lutheran and Reformed theologians essentially turned theology into an Olympic sport, where you got points for precision, there were bonus rounds for catching your opponent in a logical inconsistency, penalties for warmth. Today, we're talking about the movement that pushed back. It was called Pietism. And why it matters more than its somewhat unfortunate name might suggest. To understand Pietism, you first have to understand the world that it was born into. That world was grim. The 30 Years' War, fought from 1618 to 1648, was one of the most catastrophic conflicts in European history. It began as a religious war between Catholics and Protestants, and ended as a kind of free-for-all in which armies marched across Germany, burning, looting, leaving plague and famine in their wake. By the time that it was over, Europe had somewhere around 8 million fewer people than when it started. 8 million. Some regions lost a third of their population, others a half. Think about that. Entire villages wiped off the map. Fields left unplanted for years. Universities closed. The intellectual and spiritual infrastructure of Protestant Germany was devastated. The Peace of Westphalia in 1648 that finally stopped the bleeding, it carved out legal space for Catholics, Lutherans, and Calvinists. Your faith was basically determined by the religion of your local ruler, which sounds like a solution, but in practice it just moved the war from the battlefield into the lecture hall. Instead of cannonballs, theologians were now lobbing doctrinal treatises at each other. Dense, technical, exhaustive doctrinal essays. Lutherans drew up sharp lines around their confessions. Reformed theologians sharpened their syllogisms. And somewhere in all of this theological artillery, the actual people sitting in the pews, the common people, traumatized and war-weary, barely surviving, they're supposed to find spiritual nourishment? They weren't exactly thriving. Now, to be fair, the scholastic theologians weren't all dry robots. Some of them wrote genuinely beautiful hymns and devotional works. But as a movement, post-Reformation Lutheranism had drifted into what its critics would call dead orthodoxy. The idea was this: get the doctrine right, make sure the creed is correct, defend the confession, and everything will be fine. You know, tick the theological boxes, attend church, be Lutheran, and you pretty much fulfilled your responsibility. The problem, of course, is that you can have a perfectly correct statement of faith and a perfectly cold heart. You can affirm every point of the Augsburg Confession and still be a mean drunk who cheats his neighbors and beats his wife. Correct doctrine without transformed living isn't Christianity. It's just a more sophisticated form of self-congratulation. This was the diagnosis that a pastor from Frankfurt was about to make loud and clear. So, meet Philip Jacob Spener, born in 1635 in Rappoltzweiler in the Alsace region. Today that's in France, right on the border with Germany. His early life reads like something out of a 17th century novel. Spener was raised not by his parents, but by his godmother. She was a noblewoman of genuine piety, and her court chaplain, Joachim Stoll, who became his mentor and spiritual father. It was Stoll who introduced the young Spener to the writings of the English Puritans, writers like Richard Baxter and Lewis Bailey, whose book, The Practice of Piety, had been a bestseller across Protestant Europe. These Puritans had something like the German scholastics often lacked, a deep concern for the interior life, for genuine conversion, for faith that showed up on Monday mornings, not just Sundays. Spener went on to study theology at Strasbourg, where his main professor was Johann Danhauer, one of the sharpest Lutheran theologians of that century. And Spener loved him. But even as he mastered the scholastic method, something was stirring in him that went beyond academic theology. When he took his first pastoral charge in the city of Frankfurt in 1666, Spener came in with a vision. Lutheranism needed a reformation within its reformation. His sermons hammered home the necessity of a living faith, not just intellectual assent to correct doctrine, but genuine transformation of life and character. And then, in 1670, he tried something radical. You ready? He started a home group, small group. Yeah, no, it doesn't sound that radical to us. But in the 17th century, Lutheranism, the idea that ordinary lay people would gather in a home without a trained clergyman teaching them and leading the whole show, for them to be able to discuss sermons and pray together and encourage one another in the faith, that was a genuinely countercultural move. Spener called these gatherings collegia pietatis, the schools of piety. We call them home groups, life groups. The established clergy, they were not amused. In 1675, 5 years later, Spener was asked to write a preface for a reprint of sermons by the Lutheran devotional writer Johann Arndt. But what he turned in was less a preface and more a manifesto. He called it the Pia Desideria, the pious wishes, and it became the foundational document of the Pietist movement. Spener laid out 6 proposals for the renewal of the church. They're worth knowing because honestly, I don't think they're outdated. First, he said people need to get back into the Bible, not just hearing it read in church, but actually studying it themselves in small groups together. Second, he called for the recovery of the ministry of the laity. You know, the Reformation had proclaimed the priesthood of all believers. Well, it was time to actually start practicing it. Third, there was a need to connect doctrine to life. Knowing the right things must produce doing the right things. Fourth, he called for a charity, to be charitable in theological disputes. Yeah, for sure, defend the truth, but stop treating your theological opponents like you're trying to burn them at a verbal stake. Fifth, there needed a reformation of how ministers were trained. Seminaries should form the whole person, not just the intellect, but the soul as well. A pastor who can write a brilliant dissertation on justification but has never learned to pray is dangerously under-equipped. Sixth, people needed to be preached to, not just scholars preached to. Sermons should edify the farmer, the widow, the apprentice, not just impress theology professors and pastoral peers. The Pia Desideria made Spener famous, and that means it also made him enemies. Lutheran theologians attacked him. Pastors complained. Some accused him of undermining the confessional order of the church. But the movement grew anyway. Every movement, well, it needs both a philosopher and an activist. Spener was the visionary. August Hermann Franke, he was the man who made it real. Born in Lübeck in 1663, Franke was a brilliant student of biblical languages at the University of Leipzig. He knew Hebrew and Greek, the works. But in 1687, something happened that changed everything for him. He was preparing a sermon on a text that he admitted he didn't really understand. And during his preparation, he was seized by a profound and terrifying conviction of his own sinfulness. He described it as a complete collapse of his sense of security before God. He literally hit the floor. He cried out to God, and then he said it was as if a hand had turned on a light. His anxiety vanished. He rose from his knees, a very different man. Now, he called this a struggle of repentance, followed by a breakthrough. This intense, datable, emotionally dramatic conversion experience became, well, something of a template for Pietism. If you couldn't point to a specific moment of crisis and resolution, some Pietists question whether your faith was genuine. This would cause its own problems down the road, but it also produced some extraordinarily serious disciples. Franke returned to Leipzig and basically started a revival. Bible studies, prayer meetings, earnest conversations about faith spread throughout the university and overflowed into the town. Now, the faculty was horrified. The city council wasn't pleased. Then in 1690, Franke was expelled from Leipzig, and they thought, well, that's the end of that. It was that expulsion, ironically, that launched him into his life's work. Through Spener's influence, Franke was appointed to the new University of Halle, where he would remain for the next 36 years. What Franke built at Halle is one of the most remarkable stories of faith in action in the whole history of Christianity. He started with a school for poor children, then an orphanage. After that, he started a home for indigent widows. That was followed by a teacher training institute, then a medical clinic, then a home for street beggars, then a publishing house for Christian literature, then a prep school for upper-class students, all of it run on faith, prayer, and the steady stream of donations that Franca trusted God to provide. There's actually a famous story from that time that when Franca was down to his last few coins for the orphanage, he knelt and prayed, and that same day a substantial gift arrived in the mail. He kept a record of these providences like a spiritual ledger. It's really hard reading his journals and not being moved. By the time that Franca was done, Halle had become the most influential Protestant institution in the world. Missionaries trained there went to India, Africa, North America. It was a living demonstration that Spener's little church within the church could change the world. The story of pietism, it doesn't stop there. Count Nicholas von Zinzendorf, born in 1700, was Spener's godson and Franca's pupil. He grew up soaked in pietistic convictions. And in 1722, he opened his estate in Saxony, a place that he called Herrnhut, meaning under the Lord's watch, to a band of religious refugees that had come from Moravia. Now, these were the descendants of the old Bohemian Brethren, the followers of Jan Hus, who had survived more than two centuries of persecution. Under Zinzendorf's pastoral leadership, they were spiritually revived and organized into what became known as the Moravian Church. The Moravians became the greatest missionary force in the 18th century. Proportionally, no denomination before or since has sent more missionaries relative to its size. They went to the Caribbean to minister to enslaved people. They went to Greenland. They went to South Africa. They went wherever human beings were suffering and the gospel had not yet been preached. In 1735, a boatload of Moravian missionaries boarded a ship to Georgia in the American colonies. On board with them was a young Anglican clergyman named John Wesley. Well, Wesley witnessed on that voyage the calm faith of the Moravians during a violent storm that had Wesley himself white-knuckling his armrest in terror. It shook him to his foundations. Here were people who clearly had something he didn't. He went to Georgia as a missionary and came back a failure by his own admission, but the seed had been planted. Back in England, at a small meeting on Aldersgate Street in London on May 24th of 1738, John Wesley felt his heart, as he says in his own words, strangely warmed. The Methodist movement was born, and the trajectory runs directly from Spener in Frankfurt to Franca in Halle to Zinzendorf in Herrnhut to that boat to that meeting room to one of the greatest spiritual awakenings in history. You know, today the word pietism has taken on some unfortunate baggage. People hear it and think of a, well, privatized faith that has little to no impact on those around it. It's come to mean a kind of emotional self-indulgence, you know, of hiding your light under a basket, of retreating from the public square into spiritual navel-gazing. And sure, some pietists did that. Every movement has its extremes. But authentic pietism was never about retreating. Franca built orphanages and schools. The Moravians crossed oceans. Wesley preached in coal fields to men whose faces were black with soot and whose souls were starved for hope. Real pietism said correct doctrine without a transformed heart is just a corpse dressed in Sunday clothes. The Reformation gave us the right beliefs. Pietism asked the right follow-up question. Is it alive? It's not a bad question. In fact, it might be the most important question any church in any century can ask itself. Hey, thanks for joining us on this tour of church history here on the Enduring Word YouTube channel. If you found this helpful, please subscribe, like, share it with someone who might need, well, a little historical perspective on what genuine faith looks like. And next time, we'll see where the river of pietism flows next. Until then, keep digging, because history is always deeper than you think.